Live in simultaneous broadcast from a hidden cornfield in Wisconsin and some time-forgotten holy of holies in the Theban Mountains of Luxor, Egypt. Intrepid Radio with Scotty Roberts and Dr. John Ward.
Needless to say, the beast was stunned. A whip crack went his rumpet tail, and the beast was done. He asked us, "Be you angels?" And we said, "Nay, we are but men." Rock.
And good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Here we are at the... Where are we, John?
Well, I know where I am. I'm in Sweden. You and your little...
I'm in Wisconsin. I think I forget that sometimes. John Ward sitting over there in Sweden, me in Wisconsin. You're listening to the Intrepid Radio program right here on the IPBN Alternative Talk Radio Network. And you just got off of Rocky Stucci's show, if you're listening still from that show. And we have a very different tone for our show than Rocky had tonight. But the Intrepid Radio program has always been one that focuses on history, archaeology, alternative history and archaeology, alternative origins. And we sometimes, yes, wander over into that woo-meistering side of things. But John Ward is there to keep us straight on the right path. How you doing over there tonight, Brother John?
I'm doing fine, brother. How are you doing?
I'm good.
We've got
a fantastic guest.
That's going to be indeed, actually.
Coming on after the bottom of the hour break is Nigel Hetherington. He is the founder and CEO of PastPreservers.com. And we're going to talk about that with him a little bit. If you don't know what Past Preservers is and who they are and what they do, just go over to PastPreservers.com. And I think you can even find them under the same name, Past Preservers, on the social networks, on Facebook and Twitter. And you'll find out a little bit more about Nigel. We'll introduce him more after the break. I think I want to talk about some of the things that really, John, focus around your work, what we do with some of the things we're engaged in, like History Trippers, Paradigm Symposium, building up to what we're going to be talking about with Nigel tonight. That is really giving those of you who might be new to this program a little bit of an insight about what we do here, what we're all about, what we talk about on the show. And by the way, we just went through our second anniversary a few weeks ago with this program. So we're 2 years old, man.
My God. I feel like 100.
I know there are some days, and
it's funny actually. All joking aside, I was doing some PR work yesterday for the Paradigm Symposium, and I had a wonderful gentleman talk about how important it is at this current. I won't mention his name. How important it is at this present moment the Paradigm Symposium and what it presents and so forth. And I sat back and I was thinking about it, and I thought about giving just a normal standard reply saying thank you for your support, etc., etc. But he actually struck a tone with me. And the reason why is because I was listening to a podcast of Rocky's that was playing in the background. I had all my Facebook was all open, my Twitter account was open, Instagram, oh my God, it was social network crazy here. And it dawned on me that the majority of the people that listen to our shows, read our blogs, put comments into our posts, retweet us, and, you know, all of that, they are the informed ones. They are the ones
who are
on the cusp of what media has to offer. But more importantly, they're the ones who are actually researching the media. They're the ones who are looking at the various different news articles. They're not just relying upon one news outlet. And they're definitely not just relying upon what we're saying. They're using us in some respects the same as they would use their news app. They're using this as a catalyst to continue their research into the current day events, especially the geopolitical situation.
Well, I thought it was actually funny, by the way. A lot of people out there listen to, no matter what you think of him, I don't really listen to him, although I know of him, who doesn't know of him, radio hosts that are nationally known, some of them internationally known. You know, we're talking about, what's the name of his show? InfoWars.
I knew you forgot his name. You couldn't think of it, could you? You had to carry on the sentence. It was that kind of embarrassing pause, and you went, Well, you know, those people, the very important people, you know, I think you're on about Alex Jones, but it's not your fault that you've got the senior moment.
Well, I was going to say Alex Jones. and InfoWars. And so Alex Jones is, he's somebody that I think his people, or he, listen to this program at times.
Oh, but he
listen
does,
to the Situation Room on Thursday, because there's a lot of our information. When we talk tonight, we're not talking geo-global politics or taking a bite out of the ass of the matrix of confusion in geo-global politics. We are talking about, of course, all the things that we do here and how guys like Alex Jones picks it up.
But if I may interrupt you.
Yes, please do.
Let's give a shout-out to Alex Jones. Alex, for your next show, do some research on the Spanish incursions on the Rock of Gibraltar and how the Foreign Office has actually called in the ambassador of Spain to verify these incursions into British territory, especially the waters off of Gibraltar. There you go. Now, let's wait and see if that comes up on InfoWars.
Oh, and it just might. It just might. And by the way, we're okay with it. So,
just give us a plug now and again, Alex, please.
Yes.
So what else has been grabbing you this week? I see that you were very, not that I want to go off topic, but I see that you were very emotive of the debate that took place.
Well, you know, the debate. Now, first of all, one thing that everybody realizes, or if they don't realize it, you need to realize about the debates that took place earlier this week. This was just the very first Republican/GOP debate amongst the candidates that are there. There's 17 of them, and they only had slots for 10, the highest ranking 10, in the main debate, but they did a preliminary debate with the other six people. And they were interesting debates. It's supposed to let the general public know where they stand on issues. And I wouldn't say I was so emotive about that debate, but there were things I liked about it, things I didn't like about it. I think for all the talk that people do, every time I mention, I heard this article on Fox News, and you get the world rebels against Fox News. I don't even know how they're in existence, because everybody hates them, right? Nobody watches Fox News, right? That's why they're the top number one news, cable news media outlet out there, because nobody listens to them, because they fake, they lie, and all this, and whatever. So it doesn't matter to me what people think about that. It's generally people who don't want to think beyond what they think about it that think that. So let's put it this way. Fox News did the debates. They ran the debates. And Fox News, no matter what you think of them, is an enclave. It's a GOP, RNC, camp. Let's put it that way. They're very supportive of the RNC, and they make no bones about that. Something that I found very interesting is that, in my opinion, it seemed that they wanted to take somebody like Trump, who is an outsider to the GOP, but wants to run as a Republican. They did their best to shut him down.
Well, I find it interesting that, you know, for all of the bad press that Trump gets, he came out as Top Gun out of this debate.
He did.
He came out with some stupid comments, but that's Trump. But I think he's playing his cards rather well, actually.
You know what I think he's doing?
He's using the system.
He is, and he is one of those guys. The way I saw him characterized after the debate was he's a blue-collar talker, vying for a very white-collar position, obviously.
Yes.
The President of the United States
exactly.
Is very white-collar. So
Clinton is probably the best candidate.
Oh, you just say that to tweak me. You're saying that to poke a stick at a sleeping tiger.
She's the most qualified.
Oh, my God.
She's got a good set of pins. Her face isn't too much to look at now. She could wear a plastic bag over her head. That would make things better.
Well, see, that would be the first question asked of you in a debate. I heard that you referred to Hillary Clinton as somebody who needed to wear a bag over her face.
Well, she looks like a pomegranate, let's be fair.
I don't care what she looks like.
A dried up pomegranate. You know, it's a few days old. It's been on the shelf for a while. It's that kind of, you know.
Are you quite finished?
Yeah, please continue. Sorry. Please continue.
You know who I think would make a great candidate is Carly Fiorina. Now, she was in that secondary batch because she didn't rate that high. But I don't think she didn't rate high because of the not knowing the issues and not being able to do the job. I just think there's a perception out there that a guy has to have the job, especially in the right for some reason. Well,
what about
people,
transgender then?
People view it as being a guy's job, and so she gets a little dismissed. You notice I just dismissed you. I brandish my hand on your transgender statement. You can, John, I know that you're really struggling with your sexuality, but let's leave it off the program tonight. Anyway, Carly Fiorina, I think, could be a fantastic president of the United States. The thing I like about her over Hillary has nothing to do with gender, but the obvious comparison is going to be made because Hillary, I still remember, she thinks that she deserves this position because she's a woman who's running, and she likes to run on her experience. I don't think she's got the experience needed. I don't think she accomplished much of anything. So now that's my opinion. I'm going to leave it at that. I didn't want this to be a show about politics, about American politics and American debates. But what I did find about the debates overall is they hardballed Trump with weird questions. Like the very first thing, the very opening of the debates, what did you have? You had all the candidates standing there, and the first question thrown out there was pointed right at Trump. It was, if you don't win the nomination for the Republican Party, will you here and now, by show of hands, pledge, or who will not pledge to support the candidate that is chosen to be the Republican header, that is nominated by the Republican Party, and you will pledge to not start a third party? And that was directly aimed at Trump. And what did Trump do? Raised his hand. Kind of shrugged. Yes. Yeah, there
exactly.
It is.
But staying with politics, but switching gears, what did you think of, well, first of all, did you know that Kerry has been to Egypt?
Kerry? Kerry who? Oh, John Kerry.
Yes, you know, Mr. Limp.
I was thinking C-A-R-E-Y, Kerry. Who do I know, Kerry? Who are you talking about? Oh, John Kerry, yes, yeah. Our Secretary of State.
He's got a bit of a gimp going on. I think, you know.
Well, he broke his leg.
I think that was actually a possible assassination plot, but that went horribly wrong. But that's my own personal judgment on the whole thing.
Sure.
But did you see that he was going there on basically a military thing? To speak with good old President Sisi, and made it very
probably to tell Sisi how he's not doing what America wants him to do.
I think there is that, but there is also a case that I think Kerry was sent to basically say, well, now you've built the Suez Canal, guys, you do know, can we get rid of these pesky Chinese that you're allowing into the country and the Russians that you're allowing into the country? I think it's very interesting to see what's happening there on a geopolitical level. Sisi is by far the best thing that's happened to Egypt since Falafel. The guy really is seriously, seriously cleaning house. I mean, take the Suez Canal, for instance. He made the promise that it would be built within a year. He built it within a year.
He did.
The whole new port system that will be built in conjunction with this new part of the Suez Canal, which is being funded by the Chinese, is absolutely amazing and will bring not only jobs and security to the population of those areas and to other Egyptians who would travel to that part of Egypt to gain gainful employment, but also will actually increase productivity. It will release certain jobs, not only in Europe, but also in Asia as well. And we will see an increase in the flow of freight and traffic. Now, one has to then ask the question, what are they going to do about Somalia and the pirates of Somalia, especially now that Yemen has fallen under Saudi Arabia's complete debacle of their campaign there at the moment? Because, as you know, the Red Sea has to go between Yemen and Somalia, and that is where the pirateers carry out their dreadful acts.
Yes.
So it'd be interesting to see what's happening there. We've seen America have boots on the ground in Somalia just recently, along with British forces as well. And so it'd be interesting to see what's going to take place there. Also, there's a lot of rhetoric being said again at the moment on Sudan and the good old President Bashar. They're still calling for him to be extradited and held up in the International Criminal Courts. But I don't see that happening anytime soon. But I also found it interesting, Nigeria popped up its ugly little head yesterday. They've decided, because there's an arms embargo, and this, you know, this is all part of, don't, Wusa.
Wusa, what are you doing? What are you doing?
I'm just realigning my bottom chakra.
Yes, yes.
The current fight on ISIS, now Nigeria fighting Boko Haram on all fronts. But did you know that the UN has an arms embargo on Nigeria? So they can't receive any weapons lawfully to fight Boko Haram, which is aligned with ISIS. Did you know that?
No.
So they so now they're having to manufacture their own. So they've come out with a public statement saying they are now going to weaponize Nigeria. They're going to create their own weapons manufacturing infrastructure. And of course, there's this big, big outcry in the UN. How dare they? Da 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 da.
Right.
People are starting to get worried and scared. Well, lift the sanctions. They're fighting Boko Haram. They're fighting ISIS.
Well, I think this is the problem we get into with all this stuff is when we start having sanctions, lifting sanctions. We can look at it right now and go, hey, these sanctions are bad right now. Were they good when we imposed them? Do we lift those sanctions now? What about Egypt? What about arms to Egypt? What about arms to... Why are we selling arms to Syria? We just know those are going to end up in the hands of ISIS.
Yeah, but we have to sell arms to Syria. We have to support Assad.
Of course
we
do.
Even though we may not like Assad,
Assad was the guy we were trying to take out a year ago. But now we have to support him because he's fighting against our enemy.
Yes,
or
we have
the enemy.
To support him. We should never. We've been supporting him from the very beginning, even though we've made him give up all his chemical weapons, which is fair enough. But take Turkey for instance. We're now supporting Turkey on their fight against ISIS, but we're saying nothing about their fight against the PKK, and it's ridiculous because the PKK and the KPG are absolutely the fighting force at the moment against ISIS, and we are condoning Turkey actually using them as military targets.
Yes.
This is ridiculous. It doesn't make any sense from a normal.
Well, no, it really doesn't. This is just demonstrative of all the different things that happen over there that you have to shift. You have to keep shifting policy because everything over there keeps shifting. And it's as the sands. And so the big question is, how involved are we supposed to have gotten? How involved should we not have gotten? There's a lot of truth to the claims that the United States and CIA and MI5 and all these created ISIS. It's all out there. There's truth to the foundation, to the core of some of those arguments.
We played pass and parcel. We've always played. And it's not, and it really does annoy me because it's not a conspiracy theory. It's not the New World Government. It's not the Illuminati. It is what spy and our governmental agencies do best. They create situations from which they can then control the situation as a whole. In this instance, though, we've seen the lacking of understanding of what takes place in the Middle East. We seem to get it wrong every time. It's as if we're employing a bunch of nitwits from the knitting guild.
It does make me wonder how much of this went on in ancient times. Take a look at the Egyptian government. Let's go back 3,000 years, 3,500 years. And say,
did
how
you know,
much of
actually,
this kind of...
Did you know, actually, yesterday, it was the anniversary of Claudius, or was it Augustus, or was it Caesar? I think it was Caesar.
They were all Caesar.
took Egypt. That was the anniversary yesterday.
Oh, really? Yeah. Claudius, there was another anniversary this week of something like that, and now I'm lost
Agincourt.
On it.
Agincourt. The Agincourt, where we whipped
those band of brothers.
We did indeed. Us 7,000 or 8,000 troops.
I read a great novelization of the Battle of Agincourt, and that was written by Bernard Cornwell. If you've never read any of his books, does some fantastic work on English history.
Sending me a copy in brown paper, wrapped up with string, with a nice little love note.
I'll get my people right on that.
Will you put some cologne on it so I know it's from you?
Absolutely. Yes, I'll spray it with my cologne.
Thank you, darling.
You know, and you wonder where the rumors start. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's like when I'm doing business, and I talk about John and John Ward, my partner John Ward. Oh, your partner. Oh, have we met him? That's lovely. Well, not that there's anything wrong with that, but he's not my life partner. He's my business partner,
isn't that where political correctness has gone completely up the chute?
Political correctness has gone up the chute.
Just to say something, 84 Charing Cross Road is my favorite book and my favorite film. Wonderful film. If you haven't seen it,
are you talking about the one with Hugh Grant? Hugh Grant and
No. Way before, he wasn't even born, I don't think, when they made that. Anthony Hopkins and what was her name?
I've got her face in my head and I can't think of her name.
Yes,
wasn't she married to Kenneth Branagh?
Very famous American actress.
Oh, no, I don't remember that.
She's wonderful. She plays the part amazingly. And the speech, the language between it all is absolutely fantastic.
That's like watching Downton Abbey.
It's like the
language used between the people back then. Yeah. And we're talking really only 100 years ago. So that's very interesting. Especially when you watch the way they treated it. And there was a formality to life. It's like asking. We saw that magazine when we spoke to Nigel Hetherington earlier this week, and he said, "Have you ever seen Chap magazine?" And there's that question: "Are you Chap?" And of course, John Ward dresses Chap almost all the time. Except right now, he's in his John Deere hoodie. I just want you all to know that.
I'm in my team.
Oh, yes. This is what Rainey said early today. Oh, you look like a sailor with your little blue and white striped shirt. And
join the Navy and feel a man.
A little merchant cap. And you're silhouetted over there, so I can't see you. But he generally runs around in his green John Deere sweatshirt when he's not seen in his tweeds and his cravat.
And my soft pants. It's my casual look.
Oh, it's my soft pants.
You know, actually, I can't wait to get back to Egypt. I'm missing it so much.
I'll bet. I'm missing it too.
What I'm missing is not just the heat, but the attire. I miss wearing my khakis. I know it sounds silly, but I do miss wearing my khakis. I miss wearing my boots.
Looks like I'll be joining you in November over there at Silsila.
Inshallah.
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 But that's going to happen right after the Paradigm Symposium.
I know.
And, folks,
and I just want to put a personal thank you out to everybody yesterday who I contacted, and a phenomenal response. Thank you to
there
everybody.
Was quite an outplay and out of support yesterday on the social networks, and we appreciate everyone for doing that. You know, they say that 50% of your tickets sell within the last really 2 to 3 weeks before a show. We are about 7 weeks out right now, and that is held true every year. But to be honest, I got to tell you, folks, every time we hit July, August, we sweat it a little bit because we go, wow, I don't know if we're going to make it this year. I don't know if there's going to be enough people want to come. But then it always fills up. And that's Philip Coppens was actually the person who told me that the first Paradigm Symposium. He was asking me about 2 months out. He says, so how are you doing for tickets? I said, well, we're not where we want to be. He says, don't worry. He says like that in his little Belgian voice. And he says, you'll sell 50% of your tickets in the last 2 weeks. And you know what? He was spot on. But all that to say, that's why we keep pushing it. If you're out there and you don't have your ticket for the Paradigm Symposium, go get it. If you don't know what you're missing, go check out the website. Go look at the About link on there, and you'll find out a little bit more about us. And just in case you don't know, I'm going to take this 3 minutes before we go out to break, before we have Nigel Hetherington on. And I want to tell you a little bit about the Paradigm Symposium. I know a lot of our listeners, you know all about it already. But let's just go down a very quick rundown of our people. We've got Randall Carlson this year. Randall Carlson is with Sacred Geometry International. He came with Graham Hancock last year.
I'm looking forward to his conversation, actually.
Yeah, he's been on the show.
I'm looking forward to his presentation.
He's going to talk about, I'm not going to get into all of that, but Randall Carlson is a master builder, architect, and the Sacred Geometry issue is something you need to go go to ParadigmSymposium.com, click on his picture. You'll see a little bit more about him and all of our other speakers. We've got Richard Dolan is going to be here. He's a historian and a ufologist. I think he's gotten more into the ufology just by virtue of his work, whereas he will tell you, I'm a historian and I'm a researcher, but he's becoming very well known for what he does. We've got Lon Milo Duquette, who is our keynote speaker. And Lon Milo is an occultist, a hermeticist. You're going to want to hear what he has to say. We've got Travis Walton. If you ever saw the movie and you don't know anything about Travis, it came out 15 to 20 years ago, Fire in the Sky, about the logger in Arizona who was taken up and abducted and his friends were accused of murdering him. Then he shows up again a few days later. This is Travis Walton. And they've got a new documentary that we're going to be showing at the Paradigm Symposium called Travis. And the producer of that documentary is going to be here as well. I don't know her name. She's coming along with Peter Robbins and Travis. Peter Robbins is one of our speakers. He wrote Left at Eastgate, big on the Rendlesham incident. And so you'll know Peter Robbins, very big for the last 30 years in ufology. We've got Barry Fitzgerald from Ghost Hunters International fame, Irishman. And
we don't hold that against him.
And John doesn't hold that against him. As I've said on the show before, I've got a great picture of he and Barry sitting on the love seat of all things in my living room with John has his British flag socks on, and they were arguing politics. And we've got Thomas Fusco, who's a researcher, a theorist, Micah Hanks. Everybody knows Micah Hanks. Dr. Rita Louise, researcher, cosmologist. Dan Madsen, he's a publisher and a writer. If you don't know about him, go again, all these people, go over and click on their pictures on the website and take a look at them. Edward Nightingale, more research on the Giza Plateau. Nick Redfern, prolific writer in conspiracies and ufology and governmental conspiracies. Interesting speaker. We've got Laird Scranton, who's a linguist, a researcher, an author. He's written on the Dogon and cosmology of Göbekli Tepe. Again, in honor of our friend who will not be here this year, Andrew Collins, it's pronounced Göbekli Tepe. And we have Sarah Sauterlin is going to be here, parapsychologist. She's got a show right here on the IPBN network, Mysteries of the Mind. Rocky Stucci, who you just listened to in the previous hour, paranormalist, radio host. James Swagger, Ancient Megaliths. John Ward, we all know about him. Jesselyn Wildflower Devereaux, she's shamanic practice. And, of course, yours truly, and all that I bring to the table. And we've got Jim Harold coming from the Paranormal Podcast, who's going to be hosting all of our panel discussions. And, folks,
I actually heard that you were coming in a John Ward costume for the masquerade
ball. I was thinking about it, but the pants were too tight. So,
yeah, maybe.
And, folks, we are running right up on the break, and so we're going to cut out, and we're going to be back right after this break with our guest, Nigel Hetherington from Past Preservers. You want to sit tight. You want to stay tuned to this because this is going to be a fascinating interview with him. If you wonder about archaeology and the state of archaeology and take a look at why he exists and what he does, you're going to love this. So,
and
folks,
Derek Acorn and the paranormal.
Yeah, he's not part of the interview, though. We'll get back to that later. So, folks, stay tuned. We'll be right back. Hang on.
It's a lot like riding a two-humped camel. Intrepid Radio with Scotty Roberts and Dr. John Ward. Intelligent talk.
The fourth annual Paradigm Symposium will again be bridging the gap in Minneapolis, Minnesota, this October 1st through the 4th. The Paradigm Symposiums were founded and exist to present you year after year with the very best thinkers in their fields. From ancient cosmology to ancient aliens, archaeology to esoterics, alternative history to the sciences that illuminate our understanding of who we are and why we're here. Randall Carlson, Richard Dolan, Peter Robbins, Rita Louise, John Ward, Micah Hanks, and Barry Fitzgerald, along with several other phenomenal names in their fields, will be presenting at the Paradigm Symposium 2015, held at the Crown Plaza Hotel Mall of America in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Get your tickets now for what will be another amazing, inspiring Paradigm Symposium. For tickets, go to ParadigmSymposium.com or call 651-468-8115. Come to think, leave inspired.
Imagine a place, beautiful, green, sloping mountains, and a rich, mysterious window into our ancient past. It's a culture the likes of which you won't find anyplace else. And while the place I'm describing is in Vermont, it's also the home of Inner Traditions, publishers of fine books on mind, body, and spirit for more than three decades. Inner Traditions are internationally recognized publishers of everything from occult to esoteric and spiritual books, as well as the leading authorities on alternative health, holistic healing, sacred sexuality, altered states of consciousness, and so much more. And frankly, it's not the kind of information you'll find just anywhere. Exploring the inner secrets of humanity requires thinking outside the box. And when it comes to Inner Traditions, the name says it all. All you have to do to learn more is visit innertraditions.com and you can receive a free catalog that will tell you all about their latest books and newest authors. That's Inner Traditions and Baron Company, publishers of fine esoteric books for more than three decades. Find them online at innertraditions.com.
Carl Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place, filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com.
For the thousands of wounded warriors returning from battle, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to a civilian job. These extraordinary men and women bring more than just teamwork and inspiration to the workplace. They bring proven world-class job skills. And to ensure proper placement, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right job fit. Talented, skilled, and eager to get back to work, you have the opportunity to hire a seasoned veteran. Contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home, the brave.
Are you looking for a really awesome and amazing graphic designer? How about an illustrator or a photographer? This is Rainey Roberts, and I wanted to tell you how you can get my designer, illustrator husband, Scotty Roberts, to work for you on your project. Do you have an awesome self-published book but no cover, or even worse, a cover that really sucks? Do you need a kick-ass logo for your company or some f***ing awesome graphic designs for your ads or website? Then get in touch with my husband for the best awesome kick-ass design and illustration. He knows his stuff, and he's been at this for more years than I've been alive. Go to scottallenroberts.com. That's Scott with two T's, ALANROBERTS.com, to take a look at his online portfolio of work, or call 651-468-8115. Now go out and kick some ass with some kick-ass graphic design.
Hire my dad, so he can take me to Disneyland.
You can take the boys out of the city, but you can never plug a dam in Denmark with your thumb. Intrepid Radio, with a haphazardly focused Scotty Roberts and the rollicking adventurous Dr. John Ward.
Sticking their fingers in the hole in the dike of humanity.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. John Ward over there in Sweden, me over here in Wisconsin. You know, you think Wisconsin, it's not so glamorous. It's full of cows and dairy farms and so on. But John, you're over there in Sweden. You work a quarry at Gebel El Silsila, and you've got a quarry in your backyard over there in Sweden, some ancient quarry in your little fairy wood back there.
In our little fairy wood, yes. In fact, we were only commenting the other day how damaged we are because we keep, every time we go into the garden, we keep on saying, oh, look, there's chisel marks.
Nice. Well, we have, we've got an anticipated guest here, Nigel Hetherington, and I want to tell you a little bit about him. He is the co-founder and owner of an organization called Past Preservers, and we're going to have him talk about that a little bit. He was founded by him. He's an archaeologist and media consultant, and by way of his many contacts in both the global academic field and in the media industry, he serves as the head of Past Preservers' daily operations. And throughout his years immersed in the real and the various challenges of his graduate studies and then due to his professional field work in archaeology and site preservation, we're going to talk to him a lot about this cultural heritage management. Nigel resolutely, it says here in his own bio, resolutely nurtured his design to facilitate and support the happy marriage of rigorous and scientific archaeology to innovative and, dare we say, entertaining film and media projects, which is another thing that Nigel is very involved with, which we want to talk to him about. He's a graduate of the Institute of Archaeology in the University of College London and is co-author with Dr. Kent Weeks of the Valley of the Kings Site Master Plan. And I want to welcome to the Intrepid Radio program Nigel Hetherington, live from Cairo, Egypt. How you doing, Nigel?
I'm doing very well, Scotty. Thank you very much for that wonderful introduction. And hello to you, John, as well.
Hi, Nigel. Good to hear your voice.
Well,
we've never met after all these years. We've never met, but one day, hopefully, we will.
I was going to say, I was saying to Scotty, when Scotty said to me, "We're going to be interviewing Nigel Hetherington," I said, "Where on earth did you dig up Nigel from?" you're kind of one of those enigmas amongst the Egyptologists of Egypt and the archaeologists. You know, we all know of the name Nigel Hetherington. We all see his name pop up on Facebook and along the social platforms. We see your names on reports. We see your names on books. We see your names on the credits of various Egyptologically based programs. But you're like one of these rare birds that only flies in at certain times, and if you get a rare glimpse of him, you take a photograph and say, "I've met Nigel Hetherington."
Why, that's Nigel Hetherington in that photo.
Is that Nigel Hetherington? Nigel Hetherington, I presume. You are one of those enigmas. Would that be a fair assessment of you, Nigel?
Well, I do seem to be kept locked in the office quite a lot, and so it's quite difficult. And with the last few years doing a lot of traveling between our clients and stuff, so I don't get as much time to spend at the Egyptological events that I'd love to go to, that I used to when I was at college, all the conferences and that sort of thing. So, but I'm making a big effort this year to try and get out and about a bit more among the public.
Are you going to be at Florence later this month?
I was hoping to, but it doesn't look like I will, actually.
That's a shame, because we could have met then, because I'll be there with Maria. We're giving a presentation this year on Sorcilla, along with Dr. Philippe Martinez, of course, our epigrapher on site. So it would have been great to have seen you there. But,
yeah, I mean, that looks like a fantastic event as well.
It is. It's going to be some phenomenal speakers and some wonderful, wonderful articles coming out of that.
You know, you make me think just a bit when you mention the office work and being bound and probably maybe even gagged and chained to the office and to a desk at times, and then you don't get out as much. I've got an old professor of mine, Dr. Charles Ayling. He is president of the Near Middle East Archaeological Society, as well as the chair of history at the University of Northwestern up here in Minnesota. And he had been in the Valley of the Kings and had done some archaeological work on the Tomb of Ai. And I don't remember the number of the tomb, but he hasn't been back there in over 20 years. And he's teaching and doing all his academic stuff, and he's up into his later 60s now, I do believe. And he said, "Oh, my, he says, "when you get there, see if you can get to the Tomb of A or I and take some pictures for me," because he's locked to his academic desk. So hopefully it's not that bad for you. One of his old pictures shows him in a pith helmet, even over there in the late 1970s. So very stereotypically.
Well, I do spend a lot of time in Luxor, especially over the last 18 months, because we were working, well, we finished the project in May of last year with Factor Marte on the replica tomb of Tutankhamun. So that was a big part of our life.
I wanted to speak to you about that, Nigel, and get your viewpoint. I mean, there's a lot of controversy on that, on the replica. Some people are for it, some people are against it. It's like even today, there was a news article brought out by The Guardian, I don't know if you've seen it,
that they're talking about putting... Yes, fabulous news.
I think it's absolutely wonderful news they're going to rebuild the floor at the Colosseum, yet you've got this huge proportion of...
That one,
on academia, who are against the rebuilding of the floor of the Colosseum. How do you see the preservation of archaeology and how that goes hand in hand with making it more accessible to the general public?
Well, the story that I thought you were going to raise, John, was this one that Nicholas Rees has published a paper, and he's been looking at the what Factormate did as the starting point of this work was to actually scan the tomb of Tutankhamun. And the high-resolution images are out there in the public realm. They're on their website for people to use the viewer, and study them. And that was one of their big things that they wanted to do. They wanted this to be public access. And Nicholas Reeve says he's been studying them since they were published, and he thinks that he's actually found doorways and chambers that basically been covered up, replastered, and he believes it might actually be an adjoining tomb.
Wow.
Next to Tutankhamun, yeah. He thinks it might be Nefertiti's tomb.
Really?
Yeah. So this paper's just been published, and you know, Factormate are incredibly pleased as well, because this is one of the things that they wanted to do with it. They want to be able to give people access to the material that they couldn't possibly study in that kind of detail in the actual tomb. And often, you know, previous, you know, what it's like with lots of work that gets done on archaeological missions and stuff does eventually get published, but it's not necessarily to the whole world.
Well, generally, by the time that gets published, you're woefully outdated.
Exactly. Yes. So, I mean, yes. Then getting back to, you know, your original point, John, I mean, the thing with the Valley of the Kings, and I feel very, you know, emotionally attached to the Valley of the Kings, and it's the first place I worked in Egypt and still do with Dr. Kent Weeks. And so the first time I ever went there, I felt that, you know, sort of you do feel this sort of emotional connection with it. Even with the masses, the huge numbers of people, it still is a sort of, you know, a breathtaking, a special place. But after that kind of feeling left me, it was, you know, what's going to happen to this? How is it going to survive those kind of numbers? You know, pre-revolution, we were talking, yes, you know, between 7,000 and 9,000 people a day to a place that was never intended to be visited at all. Yes. So, you know, when we started on the site management plan for the valley, there was lots of opinions, you know, that what should be done. You know, everything from quite radical to closure of the entire place to, you know, some kind of management that basically negates the problems caused by the tourists. But, you know, people want access. They want to be able to go into these places. And one of the things with replicas is that we found in other places around the world when they'd be done is that when they're being built and when it's being talked about, a lot of people are saying, oh, no one will ever go to that. No one will go inside a replica.
Well, I heard that about King Tut's tomb. They said the same thing. I remember when that was...
Yeah, and the other replicas around the world, like in Altamira and in France, are usually successful. And Tutankhamun, despite the numbers, you know, obviously being down dramatically in Egypt, the visitors, we've had incredibly good feedback from people who've been to the replica. People have, you know, they can obviously tell it is a replica, but they've still felt that it's authentic. And that's one of the things that Factormate was trying to do. They weren't trying to deceive anyone, but at the same time, they wanted people to feel that they were in a tomb.
Now, now, was this all with the, refresh my memory, is this all with the Theban mapping project
The Theban mapping project, was the project I worked with Dr. Kent Weeks, and we worked on the site management planning for the Valley of the Kings. So he's been very heavily involved in this project as well. And Factormate, you know, initially that's how I met Factormate, because they went to visit Dr. Weeks to get his opinion about their project, because the original plan for them was to scan the tomb of Seti I and the tomb of Nefertari, which, of course, are closed, technically closed to the public. So the idea was that if you scan a tomb that can't be visited and build a replica, you're kind of enhancing the visitor experience. Yes. But at the time that they went to scan the tomb, Zahi Owas had just started work in Seti in the tunnel, excavating the tunnel. So it was impossible to use laser scanning equipment in there while they were doing excavation. So Zahi actually suggested that they could scan Tutankhamun. So that's why they went into Tutankhamun. It wasn't initially planned, because obviously the tomb wasn't planned for closure then. Since then, people have talked about closure, but actually it's still open, and the kind of the jury's out on that, whether it should be closed or not.
Please clarify something for me. You mentioned that they think they have found in this adjoining tomb to Tutankhamun, they've found what they think is Nefertiti's tomb. Now, is this a tomb that, forgive my lack of knowledge on exactly what they've done there, is this something that they've discovered through some kind of ground-penetrating sonar or anything like that, or have they actually broken through into this tomb and they're trying to identify it now?
No, I haven't read the paper. It's just been published by Nicholas Reeves, and he's suggesting basically just looking from the high-resolution images that Fatemate produced from the scanning of Tutankhamun's tomb, that it looks like the walls have been replastered and built. Basically, he thinks that they either hit another tomb or the tomb was bigger, and basically that work was it was covered up. So I haven't. The paper has just been published. I believe it's on academia.eu, so people can see for themselves. But yeah, I haven't read it fully. I just saw the headline today about that. But yeah, it's very interesting if that turns out to be true, because obviously he's just noticed this from the high resolution images that have been taken.
Right, right. Well, I want to ask you a little bit about how you feel about, I know with current politics, and this is always dicey to talk about these things, when, especially when you're traveling back and forth over there, current politics and, of course, the whole ISIL, IS problem that is there, and all the desire, and it seems that I've run into this a lot in a lot of things I'm reading. We see a lot of sensationalized news from over there, and regarding the destruction of antiquities and things like that. What is your take? Because when I was there in Egypt last, it seemed that there was talk of the Muslim Brotherhood wanted to destroy this, or ISIS wanted to destroy that. And, of course, that's ramped up so much in the news and so sensationalized, especially in the Western media. What have you seen? I know Egypt is really has been gearing up to protect its antiquities from this. How are you seeing the politics affecting what you're doing? You're there in Cairo now. So how do you see it affecting Egypt? How do you see it affecting the antiquities? What's your take on this destruction of antiquities that's out there?
Well, as you said, I think you hit the nail on the head with sensationalist sort of articles in newspapers. There has not been any destruction of antiquities or archaeological sites in Egypt based on religious dogma. It hasn't happened.
Okay.
Not in the recent era anyway, or definitely not since the revolution. What is happening to the sites is that looting, of course, increased dramatically due to the sort of vacuum, the security vacuum that was created after the revolution. And also the pressures of a hugely growing population on the sites, and the expansion of industry and agriculture throughout the country, which basically has been going on for decades, but I think it's more open, and it's more openly discussed and reported what's been happening in Egypt.
Okay.
So I think that, you know, I think there have been stories, obviously, that now and again there are, you know, stories of the sphinxes as well are going to fall over, or someone wants to come and blow up a pyramid. And at one point, there was a channel here that was getting particularly vocal religious guy to come along every Friday and basically come out with some craziness. And he was saying he wanted to blow up the pyramids. Now, of course, you could find someone in America.
Sure.
That probably says they want to blow up the, you know, the Congress or whatever. Or that chap who wanted to burn the Quran, if you remember that, that
yes.
went on for weeks. There's always nutters that you can find to make a story. But I think Egypt's heritage is safe with the Egyptians. And in the main, it comes down to economics. And it comes down to, as I said, population growth. And it's a very difficult thing to balance, as you know, John can probably tell you from Luxor area, to balance this, you know, tourism with the economic needs of the local population, with industry, with agriculture, and this vast, you know, heritage that is, you know, is almost everywhere in the country.
Yes.
So, you know, if you want to build a house or you want to build a factory or you want to have a farm, you're going to hit heritage. Well, there comes a point where it all can't be saved. It's impossible to be able to save all of it.
Sorry to interrupt you there, Nigel, on that point, because you brought up a valid point there, and I agree with you to a point. I can't say, because as you know, and you're in exactly the same boat as I am, there's sometimes we have to wear different hats for different things. And in this particular instance, especially on public radio, there's certain things we can't discuss because of the political system that's currently in place. But with regards to what you're saying there, with the reclamation of, say, the desert and so forth, the you're quite right, you know, you can put a spade in anywhere in Luxor and you're going to hit antiquity. Where do you see the next 10 to 15, maybe even, say, 20 to 50 years with regards funding for archaeological missions? Because it's becoming, as you are more than aware, becoming much more difficult to secure funding necessary to sustain long-term archaeological missions. Do you see, as we are witnessing now, do you see more of a partnership with the private sector, i.e. people like yourself, media, the new technologies that we're seeing? We are currently working very closely with Insight, an American team, American company, with the digitization, we'll get there in a minute, of Sorcilla and its epigraphic material. And so, with regards funding, do you think it's something that can go hand in hand with the preservation of new archaeological sites that are being discovered on a daily basis in Egypt by the local population as they dig the foundations for their new houses?
It is a difficult one, because obviously, with, you know, the main thing that needs to be done here, and you know, we can go back to, you know, to Petrie for this, you know, and saying Egypt is like a house on fire, and it's still on fire. What do you save? You know, there have been so many attempts to build a database of sites and monuments, so many, you know, attempts to have databases even of inventories of museums, which are still not complete.
Why do you think it hasn't happened? It's so frustrating.
Because there are people working independently. I mean, I hate to say it, but, you know, the thousands of or the hundreds of foreign missions all working independently.
Why is that?
I have no idea why Egyptologists somehow won't come together.
I hope you don't mind me asking. I'm asking you for the benefit of the audience. I mean, both of us know the reasons why, but I'm asking for the benefit of the audience from our point of view, because it's very rare that the audience gets two people like ourselves speaking to them via the radio, and we can give them such an insight into. I mean, most of the general public always scream and shout and say, well, the academia, they're hiding things, especially when it comes to Egypt. The conspiracy theories are abound. Oh, we're hiding things all the time. But they don't seem to realize that it takes years, and funding is a fundamental component of the reasons why sometimes it takes years to get the material out, published, because people have to take other jobs. They have to change their careers to actually sustain a living.
And Nigel, you, by the way, have a background in finance management of some kind. Numeracy was a term that I saw come up in your bio.
I used to be an accountant for 15 years. I mean,
burn him at the stake.
My mother said I just changed to archaeology because it was the next one along in the syllabus. But you know, it's just like what's next? Antology or something. So the thing is with, I was very surprised recently to hear that the moratorium on excavation south of Giza was lifted. Now, this, you know, Zahi was a lot of things to many things to different people. But one of the things I think that he did was amazing was the fact that when he came in, he banned excavations, new excavations south of Giza, because he said essentially what all that should take place in the Nile Valley was conservation, site management, and rescue archaeology.
But it
should not be people. Of course,
it wasn't happening. I mean, let's be honest. The sites were being taken over by the pre-existing institutions, and they were sitting on these sites, and they weren't doing the job. Right or wrong, there were some fantastic projects taking place. Mm. But in general, there has been a stagnation of true archaeological research south of Giza. And I think what we've done, and I quite agree with you also, I'm not arguing with you actually on this one, Nigel, I think it was a good thing also that Zawi brought this in, but I also think it's had a detrimental effect in as much as it has curtailed near enough two generations of up-and-coming archaeologists, Egyptologists, from carrying out new and exciting excavations, archaeology in general, south of Giza. And I think the lifting of the ban now is very timely. It's coming at a time where Egypt needs to redefine itself after the revolutions. And I think it will also, of course, generate new finds, which will, of course, generate tourism. And so I think it's a very, very, very clever and very timely manner to do it in.
I totally disagree, but I think
tell us what you think about that. I'm curious.
I think it will encourage yet again more treasure hunting, more in the sense of treasure hunting, in the sense not of you know, of someone digging up antiquities and taking them home, but in the sense of this glory hunting by Egyptologists who want to find amazing sites, want to find intact tombs, want to discover the missing kings and queens, etc., etc. Egyptology in Egypt needs to change. It needs to dramatically redefine itself. And one of those ways it could do that is by literally, you know, drawing a line in the sand and saying, the first thing we need to do is to complete a site and monuments record for the entire country. That would include, you know, not just sites, but museums, the artifacts within the museums. And that should be as a sort of an international appeal. It doesn't have the sexiness of the sort of, you know, UNESCO campaigns in Nubia and that sort of thing, but it is that crucial. That's what needs to be done. The country
needs to.
Can they
not go hand in hand?
No, I don't think they can. No, I think because the obsession with finding new things instead of clearing up what's already been done. And as you said, many things are just not published. Many things are started and not finished. I mean, one of the things the MSA said they were going to be doing was reviewing a lot of the existing concessions where people say hadn't done any work for several years and stopping them.
Which they have
done.
And
I think that's great. That's wonderful.
And the rules are very, very clearly set out in MSA, which we strictly adhere to at Silsila, and that is that you have to get your reports in at the end of each season. If you do not publish your report, you will lose your concession.
Yes.
The concession is not a God-given right, and it shouldn't be a God-given right to any institution anywhere in Egypt. And I don't care who you are or how much money or what institution is backing you, you do not have a God-given right to be on that site. You have to produce results.
Young Egyptians since the revolution as well, you know, they want a bigger role in this. They want not just to be the assistants of the foreign missions and not to be they want to be equal partners in this work.
We're very pleased. I'm very proud at Silsila because Dr. Maria Nielsen, my partner and wife and boss, she's taken under her wing She is for Moman Saad, who's doing his doctoral thesis with her. And we're also taking on a few other Egyptians as well to do their doctoral thesis under the auspices of Dr. Maria Nelson. We have a huge Egyptian team, which, again, we are all on the level playing field. We all live on the same boat. We all carry out the same tasks, and we all have the same responsibilities. And we're quite proud of the way in which we conduct ourselves at Silsila and the way in which we... I would say, not uniquely, but the way in which we approach the young Egyptians, as you quite rightly put, Nigel, the young up-and-coming
Egyptians. And that's fantastic. And, you know, now, there are many like yourself, John, as well. And there are great, great work being done, great missions, wonderful relationships. The EES, particularly, you know, in the last few years as the Egyptian Exploration Society, if people don't know it, based on London. They've done, you know, under the new directorship,
Chris.
They have done of Chris Norton. Yeah, wonderful work and a real change of direction. And I think an organization like that saw that the world was changing, the world of Egyptology, not just because of the revolution, but because of many other things.
While we're on that subject, Nigel, what is your take, your personal and professional observations of error and the way in which it conducts itself in Egypt as an archaeological mission?
I have not really had much contact with them, so I can't really... I mean, I read their reports and things and go to their websites, a usual resource and things like that, but I've not really worked with them. Obviously, is Mark Lehner's organization still part of that, or is that separate?
It's still very much part.
I've heard very good things from the Egyptians who work with Mark Lehner. I mean, the training school there, and fantastic things about that. All the Egyptians that we've worked with over the years all love Mark a lot. They like working there. They get a lot out of it. And the field school has a good mix of people coming from overseas as well, so there's a lot of interaction between young archaeologists from all around the world as well that come to that field school.
Well, that's...
And we filmed a few times at the, obviously, their site, but we've not had a huge amount of contact with the organization itself. So, because mainly, you know, my archaeological work and conservation work and site management has been in Luxor. But filming-wise, we've done a lot there at Giza.
Well, I want to talk to you a little bit more about your filming, but we're right up on top of a break. And so hang on, everybody. You're listening to the Intrepid Radio Program with Scotty Roberts and John Ward, and our guest today is Nigel Hetherington of Past Preservers. And we're going to come back in just a few minutes right here on the IPBN Alternative Talk Radio Network. Sit tight.
It's a lot like riding a two-humped camel. Intrepid Radio with Scotty Roberts and Dr. John Ward. Intelligent talk.
The 4th annual Paradigm Symposium will again be bridging the gap in Minneapolis, Minnesota, this October 1st through the 4th. The Paradigm Symposiums were founded and exist to present you year after year with the very best thinkers in their fields, from ancient cosmology to ancient aliens, archaeology to esoterics, alternative history to the sciences that illuminate our understanding of who we are and why we're here. Randall Carlson, Richard Dolan, Peter Robbins, Rita Louise, John Ward, Micah Hanks, and Barry Fitzgerald, along with several other phenomenal names in their fields, will be presenting at the Paradigm Symposium 2015, held at the Crown Plaza Hotel, Mall of America, in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Get your tickets now for what will be another amazing, inspiring Paradigm Symposium. For tickets, go to ParadigmSymposium.com or call 651-468-8115. Come to think, leave inspired.
Imagine a place, beautiful, green, sloping mountains, and a rich, mysterious window into our ancient past. It's a culture the likes of which you won't find anyplace else. And while the place I'm describing is in Vermont, it's also the home of Inner Traditions, publishers of fine books on mind, body, and spirit for more than three decades. Inner Traditions are internationally recognized publishers of everything from occult to esoteric and spiritual books, as well as the leading authorities on alternative health, holistic healing, sacred sexuality, altered states of consciousness, consciousness, and so much more. And frankly, it's not the kind of information you'll find just anywhere. Exploring the inner secrets of humanity requires thinking outside the box. And when it comes to inner traditions, the name says it all. All you have to do to learn more is visit innertraditions.com and you can receive a free catalog that will tell you all about their latest books and newest authors. That's Inner Traditions and Baron Company, publishers of fine esoteric books for more than three decades. Find them online at innertraditions.com.
Carl Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place, filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com.
For the thousands of wounded warriors returning from battle, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to a civilian job. These extraordinary men and women bring more than just teamwork and inspiration to the workplace. They bring proven world-class job skills. And to ensure proper placement, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right job fit. Talented, skilled, and eager to get back to work, you have the opportunity to hire a seasoned veteran. Contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home, the brave.
Egypt, the cradle of civilization, land of the ancient pharaohs, where the living and the dead dwell side by side, and home to Gebel El Silsila. Beautifully situated in Upper Egypt amongst the bulrushes of the iconic River Nile and the ever-advancing sands of the evocative Western Saharan Desert, lays undisturbed 75 million years of Egypt's vast history until now. That is, when one thinks of Egypt, one automatically visualizes pyramids, sphinxes, the massive sprawling temples and shrines, the beautifully preserved tombs of kings and queens, and not forgetting the glorious treasure of the boy king, Pharaoh Tutankhamun. Yet very few have ever heard of Gebel El Silsila, a vast complex of sandstone quarries, ancient monuments, tombs, stelae, and now even temples, rock art, and workmen villages, not forgetting Roman roads, bridges, and forts, all associated with the quarrying of sandstone for the past 3,500 or more years. Now, Friends of Silsila brings all this and more to you directly from this ancient, wondrous site, with yet more secrets to be discovered by the team. But we need your help. There is so much work to accomplish that there's more than our lifetime's worth. Why not be part of that legacy? Immortalize yourself. Become the next Lord Carnarvon. Invest in the future. Be part of the discovery and the adventure. Why not come and participate as a volunteer? The Friends of Silsila requires ongoing funding from a wide range of sources, and there are many ways that you can donate to help ensure the continued archaeological work, guardianship, care, and preservation of this ancient historic site for future generations. We need your help, so come and join us today at www.friendsofsilsila.com, S-I-L-S-I-L-A, friendsofsilsila.com, and be part of the history. And be sure to look up Friends of Silsila on Facebook to join our group page. Friends of Silsila is a registered Swedish charity, and every penny it receives goes directly to the ongoing work at Gebel El Silsila.
Thank you.
You can take the boys out of the city, but you can never plug a dam in Denmark with your thumb. Intrepid Radio, with a haphazardly focused Scotty Roberts and the rollicking adventurous Dr. John Ward.
Sticking their fingers in the hole in the dike of humanity.
All right, folks, welcome back to the Intrepid Radio program. We are here with our guest, Nigel Hetherington of Past Preservers. And, Nigel, you had just left off before we took the break talking about having done some filming somewhere. And there's one of the unique things you do at Past Preservers. And perhaps you can tell us a little more. And, by the way, is that Cairo traffic we're hearing out back there?
It is. There's a bit of a party going on for inauguration of the Suez Canal.
Nice. Oh, yes, yes. I remember when John and I were there, we were broadcasting live from somewhere near Giza, and there was a wedding going on in the background.
Oh, so you know they're a noisy affair. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness, yes. At Past Preservers, tell people a little bit about the mission behind Past Preservers and then what you do. You've got a lot of projects that you're working on at Past Preservers.
Well, essentially, what Past Preservers, reasons for existence is that we're both archaeologists, myself and Kelly Krause, where we're working in Egypt at the time when we thought about the idea for the company. We were both working in the Valley of the Kings, and we had a lot of contact with the media who were making documentaries, mainly with our boss, Dr. Kent Weeks, because, as you know, he does a lot of TV work and is very popular on television, talking about his discoveries and his life's work here in Egypt. And while we were working with them, we would start, on a sort of freelance basis, helping them out, doing a little bit of research, helping them find the correct locations to film in, finding the right expert to talk about a particular subject. And we started thinking, the media, there's a lot of misconceptions about, the documentary world and the media, as if
sure.
They sort of intentionally set out to make bad TV. Or to make mistakes, and of course they don't. They set out to make entertaining TV programs. That's the main thing. It's entertainment. We always forget. It's not an educational thing. Sometimes it can be. There's an educational remit with networks such as PBS or with the BBC in the UK. But in the main, it's meant to entertain, and it may educate along the way. So we would be asked by them, where should we shoot this scene? Who should we talk to? But the emphasis being on obviously the visuals and obviously the information they wanted to, portray back to the public at home. So we thought, look, as archaeologists, Egyptologists, if we can help them make better TV programs, it's a win-win situation. So our people, the people in academia, our colleagues, will not get so upset about what's being produced, and the media will produce better TV shows if we can help them. So we thought, look, what we'll do is we'll set up this company, and it was in Egypt initially, and we'll act as mediators between the two worlds. We'll try and find the best experts for the shows. We'll find the best locations. We'll do the research for them so that they're, we're checking everything, fact-checking and looking into that. And we started off just over 8 years ago in Egypt, and we were very lucky. We got onto some really high-profile projects from the beginning, and it started from there, really. But how we developed our relationship with the media, we would be working as we were then with our archaeological projects as well. And when they were leaving Egypt, they would say to us, we're off to Greece tomorrow, or we're off to Italy, and we're making a show. We would love to have a Roman expert, but we don't have one. And we said, sorry, we can't help you. We only have Egyptian and Egyptologists and archaeologists on our books. So we thought, well, why limit ourselves to that? We should limit ourselves really, to the markets our clients are in, and our markets predominantly the English-speaking television world, so Canada, Australia, New Zealand, America, and the UK. So we started to put together databases of experts and encourage people to sign up on our database on our website, which is completely free to register. And we built it up over the last 8 years, and now it's phenomenal. I still can't believe it. You know, it's like we have 1,400 experts, a sort of equal split between male and female.
Well, hopefully, and they don't all work in your office there.
No, they don't. But they do come and visit us sometimes, and we do. You know, we keep in regular touch with them, and those experts. They're called what the media would term as contributing experts. So they're people. The other term that's used a lot is talking heads. You might have heard of,
yes,
which I don't
really
like that much. So they're a person that they would say, okay, I'm going to do a documentary about the Hatshepsut, or I'm going to do a documentary about the Colosseum, and I need someone to talk for a few minutes.
Okay.
So we provide those, or they do the research as well for the companies. But a few years ago as well, one of the companies we were working for said, look, we're always looking for the next generation of presenters, so people who can actually not just, you know, contribute to a program, but who can actually hold a program themselves and can present the information to the public in a very accessible way and be enthusiastic and really, you know their subject. So we started looking through our databases for people like that, people who wanted to develop a career as well in the media alongside their academic career or their excavation work. So now we actually have an agency that sits alongside our work as well. So we represent 17 presenters currently who are the archaeologists, historians, explorers, but they're also looking to develop, as I said, a sort of parallel career in the media.
Yes.
So that's really where we sit. We sit between the two worlds. We try and facilitate the relationship. We try and mediate in cases where it goes wrong. And we try and make... help the media make a good quality project.
Now, do you just sit as consultant and offering consultancies to many of these programs, or do you actually produce, or are you producers on some of these? Because I see quite a host of shows and programs that are on your website.
We contribute in many ways. When we started out, I wouldn't like to say that we were producers. We were just researchers. I would call ourselves, you know, we were doing research, and we would be doing what's termed as, you know, sort of location fixing and casting work.
Sure.
But I now, myself personally, I have production credits as a field producer, as an assistant producer, as an executive producer on over 20 projects. So I learned on the job.
That's got to keep you busy.
Yeah, this is why the John was saying they don't see me at the archaeological conferences anymore, because we're doing that most of the time. And in fact, we just started work yesterday on our 30th project. So, you know, been phenomenal. And obviously, sometimes that work can be just a few weeks, or it can be in one of our biggest projects we ever did, which was quite controversial, Chasing Mummies.
Yes.
Zahir Wasf, History Channel. We worked on that show for 9 months, every day for nine months. So, and that was all, you know, we did lots of different jobs for that.
That has to be the kind of project that you enter into going, wow, we got this project with Zahir Wasf. And by the end of 9 months, you're like, oh, damn, I am sure glad that's over.
Can I ask you a question, Nigel, with regards to Chasing Mummies?
Oh, please do. Everybody loves to talk about Chasing Mummies, and so do I. Everyone that was on the show as well still loves to talk about it. So, yeah,
I just want to ask the controversial question.
Yeah.
Why did she wet herself? The student above the King's Chamber.
I've heard about that.
Well, I wasn't actually a producer on that episode. And I know that sounds like a politician, but actually I came in after three episodes had been shot, because I was in the UK working on a project, and one of my producer friends who was working on the job too said to me, would you come out and work with us? And I was like, yeah, of course, definitely, I'll come out. So they had filmed those. They'd shot three episodes at that time when I joined, and it was already infamous, that scene. It's still debated whether or not it really did happen. I can't say more than that, but I don't believe she actually did that.
Well, that's good to know.
I mean, that's a lot of... Chasing Mummies was probably the first of a sort of what is termed now as augmented reality. It was a very different show for the history and documentary field. It was meant to be initially a fly-on-the-wall observation documentary that followed Zahi Awas for 9 months. Obviously, it didn't actually become that. It became something else. But it was, you know, a fascinating journey through all of Egypt and through, you know, the world of Egyptology here. And even though a lot of it was, how can one put it, you know, embellished to a certain point, and it didn't follow the strict chronological path. I mean, the young kids particularly on it that were the archaeologists that were the interns as such, they were meant to be Zahi's interns, they got a lot of stick for that, and they were actually all archaeologists. They were all, you know, we recruited them. We did a big casting for the show that ran for months before the show started, and they all had qualifications, everything. The problem was that when it came to, as John will back up, when it came to working in Egypt, they couldn't. Legally, the permanent committee wouldn't allow them to take part in excavations.
Yes.
So actually what happened was we ended up with filming them following Zahi around, which is not exactly that exciting, despite obviously that, you know, he gets involved in a lot of interesting stuff, but they were unable to actually physically carry out any archaeology because they didn't have the correct permits. So it was a difficult kind of
thing. So you had to list them as actors, I suppose.
Well, they weren't actors, and in fact, that's probably one of the, if we, in retrospect, in many ways, we probably should have actually hired actors, because they were required to improvise a lot on camera, which is very difficult for someone who hasn't done that before. And so a lot of Chasing Mummies sort of slightly woodenness and awkwardness is because of that, and I think it's hilarious, and I believe it became a bit of a cult thing amongst students, and
it's,
I believe
it's entertaining.
It's very
entertaining. It is. Anything else?
Yeah.
And I think
very
entertaining. I think that woodenness that you refer to is part of its appeal, to be honest with you. I think it went hand in hand with Zowie's personality.
Yeah, there's that.
Exactly.
Well, I want to ask you a question that I'm going to step out on a bit of a limb here, and of course you can put me in my place if you need to, but something one of the shows you were involved with was Paranormal Egypt. Now,
oh God.
I saw that show, and I remember Derek Acora, who had been, prior to that, canned from one of the paranormal hunting shows.
I can't believe you brought this one up.
I'm bringing it up because I kind of like Tessa in that show.
Nigel,
but,
I have nothing to
Tessa
do with this.
Tessa was
question.
Lovely. Tessa was
yes.
lovely.
Yes. So. But here's my question.
Go ahead, Scott. Sorry,
My question is this, and John knows exactly where I'm going with this, and he's probably already got his face palmed. But you are an archaeologist. You're a scholar. You are an academic, and you're also a businessman. But there is this decided side to things in Egypt that. You can talk to some archaeologists, you can talk to some academicians out there who will all say, yes, there's something to shall we call it, I'm looking for the proper words to use here, let's use the word paranormal, that paranormal side of Egypt. You, as somebody who has been so involved in the preservation of sites, the resurrection of sites, study and research, digging in sites, and all that is associated with that from a scholarly level, have you ever encountered anything that you would personally be willing to say, yeah, I've kind of seen some strange things sometimes?
I've seen some incredibly strange stuff in Egypt, as John will tell you. You can whatever. This is one of the quirkiest countries in the world. That you see some incredibly eccentric behavior. And but no, I'm an atheist. I'm not even an ist, actually. I don't really even follow that. I don't believe in the paranormal. And this thing with that show is, and people often bring it up, you know, among our 30 shows. And whatever, and it was just a bit of harmless fun.
Sure.
To paraphrase Zahir West, when they went to ask him, and I was terrified going into his office with the producers because I thought, what the hell is he going to say?
Yeah.
And, you know, Derek Okura has a huge, again, cult following in the UK. And in the UK, it was basically aimed at that market. It was aimed as a complete joke. Not to be taken seriously at all. And he was doing lots of shows about, you know, haunted pubs and all sorts of weird stuff.
Sure.
At the time. And so we had a huge problem casting it, of course, because no Egyptologists wanted to do it. No archaeologists were interested. But the young archaeologists who knew Derek Okura and people like that, they were like, oh, yeah, I'll do it because it'll be great points with my mates in the pub and stuff. So, but when we went into Zahir, I remember the producer explaining exactly what they were trying to do, and his face, oh, you know, was a picture, and he was just like, mm-hmm. What? And he was like, this is complete bullshit. And he said, you're insane.
I could hear him say that. This is complete bullshit. I can hear it now.
Yeah, he was like, he said, I am not doing it. I will not do it. And I didn't actually want him to do it anyway. So he went, if you want to do it, but you're crazy. And so, in fact, we were allowed to do it. And in fact, strangely, I mean, I wasn't in country during the filming, so I didn't go with them when they shot it. But one of the, we cast, I think it was six or eight people in the end, because it was about 9 episodes or something of this thing. It was a lot of it. And one of the people that we cast, an Egyptologist, Egyptian, very devout Muslim, who I was really surprised that she would do it, Dr. Rawia Ismail. And I said to her, are you sure you want to do this? Because, you know, knowing her religious beliefs and everything. And she was, yes, of course, I want to see, you know, what if this guy is for real, you know, whatever, if he really believes he is a medium and whatever. And she went with him to Tutankhamun's tomb, that's that episode. And from what I remember and from what seeing the show, and I was told afterwards, he channeled Tutankhamun and started talking as Tutankhamun.
I did see that episode.
He demanded that everybody, apart from the Egyptians, leave the room or something as Tutankhamun. And apparently, you know, everyone thought this was hilarious. But our expert, apparently, she was quite troubled by it. She basically afterwards said that for a while, she felt that she was actually talking to Tutankhamun.
Interesting.
You know, and for the one person who I would have said would have completely, you know, thought this was ludicrous. But the others kind of joined in more in the fun of it, I think, than anything. I think some Egyptians that were on the show as well, there were some officials of the SCA, as it was then. I don't think really quite understood what was going on. Yeah, it is, you know, occasionally those kind of shows do come along, and a lot of people turn them down. We have turned down some projects, even though you wouldn't think it, that we took on, you know. I mean, for instance, you know, anything to, you know, that goes just a step too far. I mean, we've also taken on, you know, controversial subjects. Like, we did a very interesting show called The Victorian Sex Explorer. Unfortunate yes. title, but a very realistic, a very interesting show with about the life of Sir Richard Burton, not the wife of Elizabeth Taylor, but the explorer.
The other Richard Burton, yes.
The other Richard Burton. And this was a project that was driven by the book being read by Rupert Everett, the actor Rupert Everett.
Yes.
He read a biography of Sir Richard Burton, and he said, look, I want to find out, you know, what he did, what was his journey like. And it was it's more sort of a travel show in a way, because they went to India first and then they came to Egypt and followed the journey of Sir Richard Burton. And we took it on despite the fact that obviously what Rupert Everett wanted to do was to go into the subcultures of Egypt, the drug takers, the prostitutes, the homosexuals. And the thing was, the government didn't want anything to do with that. They didn't want to be involved in that kind of project. So, wow. I mean, it was basically, you know, some in India, he had no problem with that. India, the Indian authorities were apparently fine with him looking into the subcultures. But here we had a lot of trouble being able to get permission to film in, you know, in bathhouses and this sort of thing. Because they were the places that Richard Burton went. He hung around with prostitutes and drug takers and the rest of it. So in the end, the Egyptian part of the film was quite short. It was only about 15 minutes of the hour, simply because it was so restrictive what we could actually film here. We try to, you know, facilitate as much as we can with program makers to help them get access to these worlds. But sometimes it is difficult with the political situation.
Sure.
And it can be even when it's an Egyptological project as well, it can be difficult. Some people don't want to talk about particular subjects on TV, about the politics behind decision-making on who gets to dig where and what's going on and that sort of things. It can be contentious as well.
Well, I'm sure that there could be times, too, where they might think over in that political environment that they could run the risk of having a permit pulled. So I can understand that.
Yeah, it is difficult. I mean, the permitting process is one of the things that is, you know, that we don't do the permits. I mean, we're not fixers. We work with incredibly talented Egyptian fixers who do all that kind of thing when we're working on Egyptian projects or wherever we're working. Local fixers are the people who do that kind of work. Essentially, what we're about at Past Preservers is mainly the people. Our big thing is our experts and our presenters and our researchers. And we work with, especially the last few years, our real focus has been on developing projects with our presenters, getting their own ideas to screen, and working with the media to present with them what's going on in the world of archaeology and history and what is the new research. So we're always encouraging our experts to come to us with their projects, with their ideas for shows, because the media need constant new ideas.
Absolutely. And I agree with you on that, because, there are many of these shows that are out there that sometimes it's the same tiring old thing. And from what I've seen of a lot of the clips that you have over on your site at pastpreservers.com is people can go there and look at a lot of the clips that you've been involved with or that you've produced. And there's some very good shows in there, and some I've seen before I even knew it had anything to do with Past Preservers. So there's quite a bit, like you say. You've got 30 of them right now. So you have this expert database. You have what you call your ideas factory to develop this exciting and original formats for television, for radio, for film. You've got your media projects and your media consultancy. And also your expert registration. I think one of the first times that I really ran across you online, and this is what made me want to look into you. Now, John and Maria knew of you long before I did, but you had actually had a photo contest, and I had submitted a photo to your photo contest. And that's what got me interested in looking you up. What is Past Preservers all about?
Did you win, Scotty?
I didn't, sadly.
Did you come in the top 12?
We came in somewhere, I don't know if it was honorable mention. It was a picture of John and I walking toward down the Isle of Sphinxes towards Luxor Temple.
That should have been one of the first prize.
I remember
should have won
it.
It was a stonking
photograph. It was a great picture.
Maria took that of John and me walking toward the temple.
I think this is a prime time to hit Nigel up on that photograph.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, that's we started that a few years ago. We just decided that one day in the office we should have a calendar. Let's make a calendar. And then we said, well, what should we do? Should we take images from our shows, or should we take images that we've taken in Egypt. And we're like, no, let's ask our experts to send their pictures of their favorite dig or their favorite site. And the first year, I mean, we were amazed. Like, we got so many pictures the first year. And I think this was the fourth year, just finished. And we had this last year, we had, I think, about 170 entries. And such amazing pictures.
Amazing photographs.
Including yours. Oh, yeah. I mean, just wonderful stuff. And also...
Good comeback, you know, there, Nigel.
Yes.
Showing the, you know, the breadth and depth of, you know, what people are working on around the world as well. And this year, actually, excitingly, we're working with... closely over the last year, the Ancient History Encyclopedia website.
Yes.
We do a couple of projects with them. One is, I'll tell you about it in a minute, but they are going to get involved in the photography competition with us this year. So we're going to try and make it even bigger and get even more entries in. And they're such a wonderful resource. And they have, you know, I mean, they're now the... world's biggest history website, bigger than the Louvre and the BM together. So, you know, they're phenomenal. They've come, you know, I think they've been going about 6 years or so, but they've really just massively grown in the last couple of years. And we're working with them actually to launch their own YouTube channel. One of the things I'm interested in is the way that the media landscape is changing and how people are viewing media. And young people are increasingly, you know, viewing media on demand as such. So they're not watching, you know, programs as they're broadcast. They're choosing when to watch them. And a lot of that is people, you know, watching things on YouTube or other video on demand services. So with Ancient History Encyclopedia, we did a huge, big casting for two presenters, a male and a female presenter last year. And we found two wonderful presenters, Trevor and Sheila. Oh my God, I just realized that I wasn't meant to say that yet.
Oh, but, oops. Mum's the word.
Yeah, next world exclusive. Trevor and Sheila are going to be the faces of the AHE YouTube channel. But we'll launch later this year. And we're going to be producing content. We've set up a company, Past Preservers Productions, based in the US with three partners. And so we will be producing for the first time exclusively our own content, but for the Ancient History Encyclopedia. So we start production actually tomorrow in New York City, filming the first of the, what we would term is basically complementary content to go with the encyclopedia.
Sure.
Entries. So for instance, if you go to look up, you know, ancient Egyptian religion, you'll get a video as well of someone with a story that relates to that.
And that has got to be a huge project. I'm sitting on that website right now looking at it. It's it, folks, if you're listening, you want to look at it. It's ancient.eu. And if you go over to that, the Ancient History Encyclopedia, wow, what a site. And I can imagine how exhaustive this could be when you start doing work on it.
Yeah, I mean, it's huge. I mean, as I said, I mean, they've grown so much over the last couple of years to this, you know, they're getting over a million visits every month now, which is, you know, just phenomenal. And obviously, we just want to be part of that. And,
right.
You know, we can reach a whole new audience of people for us. It's wonderful. But also, we can get to produce content that we totally control, that is produced by our experts, presented by our experts. You know, it's going to be, you know, it's wonderful. We hope the start of a great relationship with them. We're going to start with producing the first 50 or so of the most popular definitions. We'll produce video content to go along with that. But we have aspirations to do longer features, small documentaries, short documentaries. Also to produce maybe a weekly sort of newscast where we will have, you know, Skype interviews that we can go to people in the field. So we can go to John down in Luxor and find out what's going on over there. And we can go to someone over, you know, in Australia and look at what they're doing. Again, utilizing our experts got this wonderful resource of people who are doing wonderful work. And again, going back to the photography competition, every time we get those images in, we realize that people are working on such great stuff, and really a lot of it will never see the light of day. So wow. This is another way of saying to people, you know, look at what you know, John's doing, and look at what so and so is doing in Australia, and look at what someone else is doing in the USA. And so we're really excited about it. I think that, you know, the media landscape is changing dramatically, and the people, more and more people producing their own content and getting the message out there. At the same time, the media is changing as well. I think that I was discussing this with a colleague just today, that the traditional broadcasters, the networks like History and Discovery, Nat Geo, they are making a kind of a bit of an about turn. I see that history and archaeological documentaries are coming back in favor. The sort of reality TV bubble is bursting. It's slow. The wind is going out of it slowly, and there's less being commissioned. And what is interesting is that we're being approached much more by people saying, look, we want to make a show about archaeology. We want to make a history show. What have you got? What presenters have you got? What ideas have you got? So I'd say to people out there, you know, please do sign up on our expert database. Please do get in touch with your projects, because it really is the right time now, because it is changing. And these companies do want to make
art. Well, that's good. Content. That's good, because one of the things that we had heard over previous months with a project of our own was that networks like the History Channel are more engaged in bringing on less historical content shows and more shows that revolve around hillbillies fighting alligators in the swamps of South the United States. And
exactly, but there's been a dramatic change, because I must get this right, but I think the heads of A&E, which obviously run the various channels, and Nat Geo and History and stuff, there's been a lot of change at the tops of these organizations. And in Discovery particularly, there's been quite a few trade shows, industry trade shows held over the last 6 months or so, where people from the heads of these companies have basically come forward and said, we no longer want to make this stuff. Go back to your people and come back to us with, and literally you could hear people sort of tearing up their pitches that they had for reality TV shows.
Nice.
And they're saying, look, and in fact, Discovery, if I'm correct, I think it is, I've just hired someone from HBO documentary division, because they said, you know, we want to start to make good storytelling again. It's back. That's back on the table.
Fantastic.
I mean, reality TV, I don't think will disappear, because there are certainly a number of people who are really love watching that kind of stuff, and also it's inexpensive TV, or can be inexpensive TV to make. But it would appear, for all intents and purposes, from what we've heard and from the number of people who are getting in touch with us for castings and for ideas and this sort of thing, that the media landscape is changing.
Sure. Well, that's awfully good, because I remember the complaint about I'm not picking on the History Channel, just they're overt with their name. They're out there. I remember one of the complaints used to be, the History Channel. That's the Nazi Hitler channel, right? And because every time you turned it on, that's all you saw. But then it turned to all the other types of programming, the reality television. So it'd be nice to see them actually turn back to their namesake.
Yeah. It would, and I think they're trying to. I think they really are changing the way that programs are being made. It may be, of course, because of this change in the media landscape as well, because people like Ancient History Encyclopedia are going to have their own channels, because, you know, you can deliver content in so many different ways. You know, so many digs, and John's probably aware of this as well. I mean, in Egypt alone, but all over the world, people are filming their excavations, they're doing podcasts, they're doing video blogs, they're putting them up, and they're getting really big numbers. So people are interested.
We have a huge following.
Yes.
A huge following at Silsila. I do the Intrepid Radio live from Silsila. On site from the deck of the Dahabir, because that's our floating dig house. I do every day. We're Instagramming, we're Facebooking, and we've got our own website now because we've just registered the charity Friends of Silsila. All to do with funding, of course, as you know, Nigel. It is about awareness. And that's what it boils down to, I think. It's awareness. I think people like yourself are making the general population, the audience, more aware that there is more to archaeology than just dusty old pith-helmet gentlemen with big moustaches and talking in a jolly good show and so forth. You know, we are adventurous. We are all Indiana Jones and Lara Crofts in our own way. You know, again, chasing mummies. A great example. Yes, it was woody. Yes, it was a bit stuffy. Yes, it had Zowie Howis in it with his tantrums. But it was good television. It was informative. And I think this is part and parcel, and I've said this many times before at the Paradigm Symposium, that we continue to build bridges with not just the general population, but also with alternative sciences, the pseudoscience boys, the alternative boys, the paranormal boys, you know, because at the end of the day, again, what is the point of doing this if we're not preserving history for future generations?
Absolutely.
And that is the general public. They are the audience. They are the future archaeologists. They are the future Nigel Heveringtons of this world. And we've got to do everything we can. And our toolbox these days is over full with various different technologies in which we can capture that moment where we discover that lost temple, like we did at Silsila back in the spring when we discovered the lost temple of Kenny. You know, it was just an amazing moment, and we were able to capture it, not just personally,
and
on camera. We had
World sees it. That is what's so great. And Nigel, like you were just talking about, the media is there for people to see these things better and in better ways than they ever have before.
Exactly.
Well, like John was saying with social media, I mean, social media has completely, you know, changed how people work in archaeology and stuff. I mean, it can be controversial as well because of, you know, reporting restrictions and things like that. Sometimes it's difficult for, you know, to use things that instantly put things out when they're meant to go through a process of publication and things like that.
Of course.
But the thing is, it engages people so much, and people get so excited about being involved in the process. And, you know, you're talking about Mark Lehner's work at Giza and stuff like that, and I know they have a huge following online as well. And you'll know from your own, people like to be involved. They like to follow the process. And that way as well, talking of funding as well, you can pull them in. You can get people involved and feeling part of it, so they want to contribute to help these projects.
Yes.
And then, of course, you can highlight sites that are not just the Valley of the Kings and not just Giza and not just, you know, the big headline names, which is what we're talking about before, about, you know, the excavation and going for headline and big attractive sites that have standing archaeology and things like that. You know, there's so much more to be saved, and doing sites and monuments records. How do you get people to contribute to that? Well, you know, if you show people working in the basement of the Cairo Museum on Instagram and showing all those wonderful boxes and something, of course, people are then say, oh my God, I want to save that, you know?
Right.
Whereas just kind of, you know, asking them to pay for a computer program, most people are just going to go,
It's all about engaging. Making people aware, and that's what it's about.
Well, Nigel,
that's the only way it'll be saved. You know, I mean, going right back full circle to, you know, the Valley of the Kings and everything. I mean, my own views are, you know, quite controversial on, you know, how we save those sites. I mean, I personally would shut it, the whole thing. I would close the tombs because they're not built for visitation, and I feel very strongly about that. I think there are places you can visit quite reasonably. Temples, particularly, can be, if managed correctly. Even parts of temples, though, shouldn't have, you know, people shouldn't have access to, I don't believe. I think in future generations, you know, in not that far in advance, people will look back and say, "What? You let a million people go into Tutankhamun's tomb in a year? How did you allow that? How did anyone think that was okay? So I think with hindsight, we'll think, why didn't we build more replicas straight away? Why was there a discussion about even building replicas? We do need to save as much as we can. I agree, I think we can't save everything, but I think that certain things have to be saved.
Absolutely. Well, Nigel, I certainly respect and appreciate the work that you're doing. And, folks, you can go see more about Nigel and his team members and all of their work over at pastpreservers.com. And, Nigel, is there anything that you'd like to pass on for everybody if they want to talk to you? Or maybe you don't want people to call you directly. But if they want
to...
We
love to talk to people because, obviously, I'm stuck in my office and they don't see me. So... please do get in touch. Please do sign up at our expert database. We take all levels of people. So we take, people who are just setting off in their careers, students to, to people who are very long in the tooth, like myself. So,
like John. Like John.
No, John's in his prime. So,
John, I like that. John's a prime.
We always need new people on our database. We always are looking for your projects. We want to talk to you about what you think would make great TV shows. So, please sign up.
Fantastic. Excellent. Folks, this has been Nigel Hetherington of PastPreservers.com. Go check them out. And, Nigel, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Scotty. And thanks you, John, Nigel, as well.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking to you, finally.
It's a lot like riding a two-humped camel. Intrepid Radio with Scotty Roberts and Dr. John Ward. Intelligent talk.
The 4th Annual Paradigm Symposium will again be bridging the gap in Minneapolis, Minnesota, this October 1st through the 4th. The Paradigm Symposiums were founded and exist to present you year after year with the very best thinkers in their fields, from ancient cosmology to ancient aliens, archaeology to esoterics, alternative history to the sciences that illuminate our understanding of who we are and why we're here. Randall Carlson, Richard Dolan, Peter Robbins, Rita Louise, John Ward, Micah Hanks, and Barry Fitzgerald, along with several other phenomenal names in their fields, will be presenting at the Paradigm Symposium 2015, held at the Crown Plaza Hotel, Mall of America in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Get your tickets now for what will be another amazing, inspiring Paradigm Symposium. For tickets, go to ParadigmSymposium.com or call 651-468-8115. Come to think, leave inspired.
Imagine a place, beautiful, green, sloping mountains, and a rich, mysterious window into our ancient past. It's a culture the likes of which you won't find anyplace else. And while the place I'm describing is in Vermont, it's also the home of Inner Traditions, publishers of fine books on mind, body, and spirit for more than three decades. Inner Traditions are internationally recognized publishers of everything from occult to esoteric and spiritual books, as well as the leading authorities on alternative health, holistic healing, sacred sexuality, altered states of consciousness, and so much more. And frankly, it's not the kind of information you'll find just anywhere. Exploring the inner secrets of humanity requires thinking outside the box. And when it comes to Inner Traditions, the name says it all. All you have to do to learn more is visit innertraditions.com and you can receive a free catalog that will tell you all about their latest books and newest authors. That's Inner Traditions and Baron Company, publishers of fine esoteric books for more than three decades. Find them online at innertraditions.com.
Carl Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place, filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com.
For the thousands of wounded warriors returning from battle, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to a civilian job. These extraordinary men and women bring more than just teamwork and inspiration to the workplace. They bring proven world-class job skills. And to ensure proper placement, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right job fit. Talented, skilled, and eager to get back to work, you have the opportunity to hire a seasoned veteran. Contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home, the brave.
Are you looking for a really awesome and amazing graphic designer? How about an illustrator or a photographer? This is Rainey Roberts, and I wanted to tell you how you can get my designer, illustrator husband, Scotty Roberts, to work for you on your project. Do you have an awesome self-published book but no cover, or even worse, a cover that really sucks? Do you need a kick-ass logo for your company or some f***ing awesome graphic designs for your ads or website? Then get in touch with my husband for the best f***ing awesome kick-ass design and illustration. He knows his stuff, and he's been at this for more years than I've been alive. Go to scottallenroberts.com. That's Scott with two T's, ALANROBERTS.com, to take a look at his online portfolio of work, or call 651-468-8115. Now go out and kick some ass with some kick-ass graphic design.
Hire my dad so he can take me to Disneyland.
You can take the boys out of the city, but you can never plug a dam in Denmark with your thumb. Intrepid Radio, with a haphazardly focused Scotty Roberts and the rollicking adventurous Dr. John Ward.
Sticking their fingers in the hole in the dike of humanity.
Well, we're back, but you know what? We're right at the end of the show. And so, folks, that was Nigel Hetherington. We want to thank you for listening in tonight. And you know what? That was pretty fascinating stuff, John.
It was, actually. I actually really enjoyed the interview.
I did, too.
Very interesting man.
Well, say goodnight, John, and folks, we'll see you here next week.
Good night, John.
My brother's soul. And should the sky be filled with fire and smoke, keep watching over during suns. If this is to end, then we shall all burn together. Watch the flames climb high into the night, calling out, Father, oh, stand by, and we will watch the flames burn up and on the mountainside. High. If we should die tonight, we should all die together. Raise a glass of wine for the last time, calling out, Father, oh, prepare as we will watch the flames burn over and over the mountainside. Desolation comes upon the sky. Now I see fire inside the mountain. I see fire.